We have four argued cases this morning. The first is number 19-1168, Systech versus DVA. Mr. Bakaj, is that how you pronounce it?
Bakaj, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
May please the court. I stand before you today to argue on behalf of my client, Leonard Systech, a former official with the Department of Veterans Affairs in Denver, Colorado. As I'm sure you are aware from reading the briefs, Mr. Systech is a whistleblower who disclosed, among other things, that over $43 million in appropriated funds were illegally parked at the government printing office. I'm here because we believe Mr. Systech has been reprised against through a retaliatory investigation in an effort to change his behavior, that is, to quell future disclosures, as well as to chill others from engaging in lawful whistleblower activity. From the outset, and before we discuss a narrow legal issue before you today, I would like to identify four key factual points that may be helpful as we discuss the law and questions surrounding it. With respect to the Administrative Investigation Board, there were at least four concerns uncovered during the three-day MSPB hearing. First, Mr. Systech was informed that he was to appear before an AIB, the investigation, as a witness, only later to learn that he, while he was appearing, that he was a subject of an investigation, a violation of a VA directive. Three individuals were named as members of the AIB, of the Administrative Investigation Board. One of those individuals, Mr. David Isaacs, was removed from the board as he had a direct conflict of interest in the matter. Three, Ms. Clara Hajduk, one of the individuals who was a member of the board, conducted an informal fact-finding prior to becoming a member of the investigation board, thus having knowledge of some of the issues she was conducting an investigation about, therefore not being an impartial fact finder. And four, I would draw your attention to Joint Appendix page 71, where the AIB investigation identifies an allegation number four, an allegation of inappropriate use of the fact finding process by managers in the Denver CBO office.
So I guess one of the things that you're arguing is that the investigation here perhaps not itself a personnel practice, was in the circumstances here because it resulted in a change in working conditions.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I guess I'm having some difficulty with that. I think it certainly could be the case if the government conducted an investigation which was so disruptive of the ordinary work process, mm-hmm. That it might fall under that category. But here, the only thing that happened to him, if I recall correctly, is that he was subjected to a single interview. Am I correct about that?
That is correct, Your Honor. However,
I guess then my question is how was it that the investigation caused a change in working conditions if we just had a single interview?
Well, in this particular case, within the AIB, within the finding for on Appendix 73, where the board sustained the allegation that the Denver CBO office was using fact findings inappropriately, the purpose of investigations that they found within the AIB was that they were being used as tools to go after effectively individuals. Let me step back for a moment as well to talk about the larger issue about retaliatory investigations.
Well, Congress has made pretty clear that retaliatory investigations in and of themselves aren't a prohibited personnel practice, right?
Your Honor, from looking at the congressional record, Congress and the Senate record, they wanted to ensure that they did not make just any investigations to be prohibited personnel actions. There was concern that by saying that investigations would therefore be one of the enumerated personnel actions under Title V, that would create a situation where anybody can claim, for example, a security clearance investigation, I don't want to say rudimentary, but a typical investigation into fact-finding, somebody then can claim reprisal. In this particular case, what Congress did was they wanted to enhance protections for whistleblowers from being retaliated against from investigations, but they chose a middle ground. And looking back at the Russell case, because they deferred back to Russell, they did not want to change necessarily the jurisprudence in that area. In order for a retaliatory investigation to exist, one, there had to be a subsequent personnel action, which occurred in this case. There was a letter of reprimand that Mr. Systech received following the AIB. And two, the investigation the retaliatory investigations are already fall under the significant change in duties, responsibilities, and working conditions. So there was no...
But it was that it had the investigation had to be closely related to that personnel action.
Correct, and it was. So if there's a close relationship to it, then we can pull in the investigation to determine whether or not there was a retaliatory basis for the investigation. Was the investigation initiated for purposes of targeting a whistleblower?
See, I don't read Russell that way. I mean, admittedly, Russell is not 100% clear, but mm-hmm. I would read Russell as saying that if there's this close relationship, then the investigation becomes part of the prohibited personnel practice and could be considered, for example, at the stage where the government's trying to prove by clear and convincing evidence that it would have taken the same action anyway, which seems to be how the investigation was used in the Russell case itself.
Understood. And I understand that that's what a lot of individuals believe in, so far as that the investigation that can become part of the clear and convincing analysis to determine whether or not the subsequent personnel action was taken in reprisal. However, in looking at Russell, and I'll just quote this section here, it says that, quote, when we as here an investigation is so closely related to the personnel action that it could have been a pretext for gathering evidence to retaliate, and the agency does not show by clear and convincing evidence that the evidence would have been gathered absent the protected disclosure, then the appellant will prevail on his affirmative defense of retaliation for whistleblowing. And that's talking about the investigation, not just the subsequent personnel action, but was the investigation initiated for purposes of targeting an individual. So the issue, therefore, is to ensure that investigations are not being used purely as retaliatory tools.
And in fact, in your view, that Russell says the investigation is relevant to the board's analysis of the contributing factor as well as whether the government would have taken that action anyway.
Correct.
Can I ask you something else? In this case, something I don't see in your brief mm-hmm. is an explanation of what the investigation would add to change the board's a determination on contributing factor, because both Kindred, the board made a fact finding that Kindred did not have knowledge of the disclosures to OIG. So
correct.
How would this even be helpful?
It would be helpful because two of the individuals who were members of the board had knowledge of Mr. Sistek's disclosure. In fact, one individual, if I recall correctly from the hearing, Ms. Hajek, I believe she testified that she had knowledge of Mr. Sistek's disclosure prior to that because Mr. Sistek would regularly discuss his protected activity. So, and...
These are members of the board who conducted the investigation?
Correct. That's Ms. Claire Hajek. And Ms. Claire Hajek actually conducted an investigation prior to being on the board. So if we step back for a moment, in that particular case, she was... prior to the AIB being initiated, prior to becoming a member of the board, was conducting an independent, unofficial fact gathering about the exact same issues that she was appointed to be a member of the board to then investigate. So when she was appointed, she already had information that a normal investigator wouldn't have, and her mind was perhaps already tainted going into that investigation. So there's a concern about why that investigation was initiated. And going back...
Can I ask you one other... And the other question I have is, was this argued to the board?
Yes.
Where?
We were arguing that, or it was discussed before the board about the issue of how the investigation was being conducted to establish that there was a retaliatory purpose for the investigation. So as to target Mr. Sistek both through the investigation and then the subsequent personnel action.
Focusing particularly on the board members.
Correct. During the course
about reliance on Russell. I mean, I know you've got multiple different arguments you've mm-hmm. presented before us for why the investigation should be considered. One of them is the hostile work environment. Mm-hmm. The other one is the Russell argument. And then just an argument that investigation should be considered a personnel action. Maybe you've got something separate there too. Was the Russell argument made to the board?
Yes, it was during the course of the when the administrative judge requested for briefs on a specific topic, we presented briefs arguing Russell as well.
You have those in the record, like in our appendix?
I don't believe I do. I have to take a look, but we did provide those documents, or we provide that provided that brief, and the arguments are similar to what we're providing to this.
What about in your blue brief here? I guess I'm not remembering mention of the role in the administrative investigative board of somebody other than Kindred.
Of Hadjik. We discussed Ms. Hadjik's, the concern that Ms. Hadjik, at least I believe we did, about her activity, and that's one of the reasons why we're here today, is how the investigation was conducted. Okay, so when I'm talking about concerns about the fact-finding process, we're talking about the makeup of the board. We had one individual who had to be removed from the board because of conflict of interest. Two, we had Ms. Hadjik, who we were concerned about there being a preliminary fact-gathering process before she was actually a member of the actual investigative board. And we also have concerns about the fact that Mr. Sistek was informed about the existence of an investigation, told that he's going to be a witness, shows up to the interview, is told he's the subject of an investigation. And oh, by the way, the board was not convened until the day after Mr. Sistek was interviewed. So you're literally having the cart before the horse. There were a number of deficiencies throughout this process with the AIB, which causes concern that this was designed to reprise or target Mr. Sistek because he's a whistleblower.
Where in your blue brief would you direct us to for where the point about Ms. Hadjik was made?
I'd have to look it back in the blue brief, but I don't.
We should maybe do that and answer that question on the reply.
Okay.
Could I just back you up for a moment so I understand where we are? I understand the Russell argument that you've just been making. Mm-hmm. I thought also that you were arguing that the investigation itself, quite apart to this close relationship theory, resulted in a change in working conditions.
Yes.
And I started out asking you about that, but are you still arguing that the investigation alone was a change in working conditions?
Absolutely. And
how could that be when all it did was result in a single interview?
It may have resulted in a single interview, but we have to step back and understand what the purpose for an investigation is. When somebody is under investigation, and I just want to step back beyond this case because this will apply to all federal cases potentially down the road. When somebody's under investigation, potentially they're depending on the investigation, they may not be able to be promoted. There may be an impact on their...
But the problem with that argument is that, as you just said, that's true of every investigation, and it would make all investigations potentially prohibited personnel practices.
Retaliatory investigations. So it goes back to the hook that in order for us to...
That's what Congress made clear, that retaliatory investigations in and of themselves can't be a prohibited personnel practice.
And my position is that I view them as a separate personnel action as well that falls under a significant change in duties, responsibilities, and working conditions.
Because
based on Russell, on the Russell finding, as well as a 2010 MSPB whistleblower guidebook, they cite to Russell as stating that retaliatory investigations are part of a significant change in duties, responsibilities, and working conditions. And that brings me back to this key point, is that Congress wanted a middle ground. They did not want to create, as you point out, is that we don't want to have a situation where all investigations, like a security clearance investigation or a background investigation, is viewed as potentially...
Did they actually give those two examples? I don't recall that.
No. It's something I'm bringing up right now as I'm thinking through this process. That distinguishes it from a retaliatory investigation because it's being used as a tool. So in order for...
I think that's a tough argument. Putting aside the Russell point, which is different, to say that any investigation results in a change in working conditions would say that any retaliatory investigation is a prohibited personnel practice, which seems to be exactly what Congress didn't want.
Well, respectfully, I would suggest that looking back at Russell, in order to say that there has to be a retaliatory investigation, to hit to get to that point, we have to see that there was a subsequent personal action to bring in the investigation to determine whether or not it's retaliatory. We had that happen here. We went back and we looked at the genesis for why, for example, there was the letter of reprimand. The letter of reprimand was based upon what I view as a retaliatory investigation. And so that is the purpose of Russell. And I'll just quote this one point from Russell, is in its conclusion that the agency must show clear and convincing evidence that the evidence would have been gathered absent the protected disclosure to establish that the purpose of gathering the evidence was to retaliate. To hold otherwise would sanction the use of a purely retaliatory tool, selective investigations. And that's the point here. It's selective investigations. I'm not talking about investigations globally. The way I'm distinguishing it,
it's a little bit circular, though, to be honest. So there's a determination that investigations are not alone going to be a personnel action, because you don't want to chill investigations. But you're presuming that it's retaliatory before you even determine that it's a personnel action. Does that make sense?
I'm
having a hard time with that.
So the way I'm viewing is this, is that because we had a subsequent personnel action following Russell, which allows us to look back at the initiating activity, which is an investigation, you can then determine, because you're conducting fact-finding, whether or not that investigation was initiated for purposes of retaliation.
But that's your Russell theory.
Yes.
This isn't separately just focusing on your, changing work circumstances or hostile work environment theory.
Right.
And so that, just focusing on that and setting Russell aside, mm-hmm. What other things, one of the questions that Judge Dyke asked you earlier that I don't think he fully answered was, what is it besides a single interview and then a letter of reprimand? Oh, just the single interview for the investigation.
It impacts not only the client's ability to go into the office every day wondering whether or not, because they're a whistleblower, they're going to be targeted through investigation. It also impacts everybody in the office. Having worked in the Federal Government myself.
That's true of every retaliatory investigation.
But if it's retaliatory, then it's reprisal.
Okay.
I mean, that's why that's the distinction between a retaliatory investigation and an investigation. Having a security clearance investigation is not comfortable, but I know that investigation is not being designed to target me.
I think unless my colleagues have other questions, I think we're out of time. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Major.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Congress expressly did not provide that retaliatory investigations are a personnel action.
Suppose that hypothetically you had a situation where there was an investigation that was alleged to be retaliatory, and every day, every workday, the employee is called in for a one-hour interview. And would that be a change in working conditions that could?
That very likely would. I mean, the statute does cover significant changes in responsibilities, duties, and working environments. So
an investigation could end up being a prohibited personnel practice if it were sufficiently disruptive of the workday or the work process.
That's correct, Your Honor. If it rises to the level of a significant change in duties, responsibilities, or working environments, either because the employee has duties that are being shifted as a result of the investigation, or he's, as in your example, being called in regularly so that his working conditions have changed. But that is actionable under the Whistleblower Protection Act, not because it's an investigation. It's actionable because it's a significant change in duties, responsibilities, and working conditions. Again, provided
it's your position is that didn't happen here.
No, that did not happen. An hour and a half interview was not at all a significant change in duties, responsibilities, and working conditions. And there are no fact findings in that regard. The factional arguments were not made before the board. The jurisdiction, the submissions on the issues are actually included in the appendix. I know there was a question about whether those briefs with regards to the jurisdictional actions were included in the appendix. They actually are in there. They are located only an excerpt from the government briefs, but I believe we have
I don't understand
Mr. Sestak's brief.
Excuse me, I don't understand Mr. Sestak to be even arguing that point in this case. Namely, that if the inquiry were whether in this particular case, this particular investigation so disrupted his work as to come within the catch-all clause of the definition.
I believe the argument was
I don't even think that's at issue here. But you acknowledge that in a case in which there was such evidence, it might well be proved.
Yes, Your Honor. The argument in the brief that was presented, I believe, was as a matter of law.
It is right. So what about putting aside the in and of itself characterization of an investigation as a personnel action? Assume that Congress said, no, we don't want that, and putting aside a case in which the investigation causes disruption, the disruption being therefore qualifying under the catch-all working conditions clause. What do you understand under Russell or otherwise there to be in the way of a role for looking at an investigation as part of the inquiry into whether a distinct personnel action is subject to corrective action?
Well, the board should allow evidence to be presented with regards to that investigation. And if you have a protected disclosure...
Which of the elements would it bear on conceivably?
It wouldn't bear upon whether or not there's a protected disclosure. That's not an issue in this case.
Or whether there was a separate personnel action. We're assuming there was a separate personnel action. So
yes.
There's kind of two parts of the test for the link between those two things, one kind of contributing factor, the other immaterial.
I think it fits in within the contributing factor elements. Because
you say it, could you speak up a little?
I'm sorry. I apologize.
I'll try to make
sure I speak up. I said the contributing factor element, Your Honor.
That it does fit within contributing
factor. It could fit within contributing factor if we have a personnel action and we have a personnel action where those disclosures were a contributing factor. Here, I mean, it's notable. I mean, counsel...
I'm confused. I mean, it seems to me that there are maybe at least two ways of looking at Russell. One is that it says if it's closely related and if you determine that some other action is a prohibited personnel action, then you consider the investigation to be part of that prohibited personnel action, and it relates to the question of whether the government would have removed the person anyway, and it has to be part of the car factor analysis. That seems to be largely what happened in Russell itself. The alternative way of looking at Russell is that you can use the retaliatory investigation to make the finding that the other action here, the letter of reprimand, was a prohibited personnel practice. So which of those two do you think Russell leaves room for?
I don't think it would be here. I mean, possibly, I suppose, the second, but I really don't see that in Russell. I mean, focusing on the facts of this case, I mean, we have, although it's not in the appendix.
Forget about the facts of this case. How do you interpret Russell? What is the significance of a retaliatory investigation that's in some way closely related to another personnel practice?
If the relationship, well, first off, has a direct relationship in terms of damages you could recover for the personnel action that you would have corrective action for. So that's expressly included elsewhere in the statute at, I believe it is, 1221G4. So it's an element of damages, that enhanced damages that were provided in the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act. With regards to receiving that evidence and where quite fit in, Russell isn't entirely clear about how exactly it fits in. It does provide the board should consider evidence. The Russell case, we had demotions and other actions against the whistleblower that were expressly found to be contributing factors. So it's difficult to exactly figure out whether or not it's listed as a pendant, whether Russell intended, how Russell fit it into the scheme. And I don't think you can. I don't think you can get that really from Russell, because Russell is rather ambiguous. The board clearly was.
Statute preserved Russell.
Statute preserves Russell, and that's it. It preserves the definition found in Russell for retaliatory investigations, and takes and incorporates it into the damages measure, because the.
Well, apart from the damages measure, it preserved Russell's holding?
I believe it does, Your Honor. Because Congress was expressly aware.
So that leads us to figure out what Russell meant.
Yes. But one of the difficulty, or what Congress felt Russell meant. And if you turn to legislative history, you know, Congress expressed a clear concern about chilling investigations, including management inquiries into potential wrongdoing in the workplace, as here. So it wasn't simply just about chilling security clearance investigations. It's about investigations into wrongdoing, which were the concerns here. There was an individual at VA who was in an inappropriate relationship with an inferior officer or inferior subordinate. And so there was a reason to investigate that and to try to determine what had been done in order to try to remedy the situation. Mr. Sistek ended up wrapped up in that because Mr. Sistek had a conversation with the individual and failed to take any further action on that. I'll note that initially, despite the focus on Ms. Hadjik, Ms. Hadjik and Ms. Nightingale's recommendation at the conclusion of the investigation was that no charges against Mr. Sistek should be sustained. It was only later, after Ms. Hadjik retired, a second individual came in, Nikki Craven, and Ms. Craven had recommended that because he had failed to take any action, that he be subject to receiving a letter of reprimand in his file. So neither of the investigators had recommended any action against Mr. Sistek. It was only subsequently when Ms. Craven came in, and Ms. Craven testified, although this is not found in the record before this court, Ms. Craven had testified at the hearing that she had no knowledge of his disclosures. And that was, although we have to acknowledge there's no fact finding specifically from the board on that.
So suppose it were the case, and I just assume this, perhaps contrary to the record in this case, that Ms. Kindred did know about one or more of the protected disclosures, whether the 2012 or 2013 ones, or maybe the February 4th one, and could be found to have initiated the investigation knowing of those disclosures, perhaps with a retaliatory motive, and then it gets to an ultimate decision by, was it Ms. Amos who issued the letter of reprimand in the summer of 2014? Would the retaliatory character, by assumption here, of Ms. Kindred's initiation of the investigation bear on whether to attribute to Ms. Amos's decision the investigation as a contributing factor?
I believe it would in that case. Yes, under that hypothetical. And that's not the case here, because neither Ms. Amos nor Ms. Kindred were found to have actual or constructive knowledge of the disclosures. But in that case, yes, I think that hypothetical.
Well, there's a paragraph about Ms. Amos which says neither actual nor constructive of any of the disclosures. The preceding paragraph about Ms. Kindred refers to the 2012 and 2013 disclosures, but not to this February 4th disclosure. It just doesn't say one way or the other.
But the problem is February 4th is after the AIB and the investigation had already occurred.
I understand there may be an important, and I don't mean to diminish it, technicality about whether the investigation was launched by January 29th or not till the next day on February 5th.
Your Honor,
there's just no finding about that.
Yes, and Your Honor, let me note, just to clarify for the sakes of the record, in his reply brief, petitioner contends it's suspicious that the board was appointed, that heard him, was appointed the day after. But that isn't suspicious, quite simply because he had already been called in for the interview The board had been appointed with three members. Some concerns were raised, and the record reflects concerns were raised about one of the members. So they chose to proceed with simply two members, but that required a new appointment letter. So the appointment with one of the investigators having been removed, a new appointment letter had to be issued, even though initially it was going to be with three individuals. So I don't think there's anything suspicious at all about the timing on that.
Do you think, getting back, I guess, a little bit to the legal structure surrounding what it is we are to decide, that Congress sufficiently endorsed Russell, that our task is to figure out what Russell said, or using some kind of endorsement of Russell as a springboard to indicate what role an investigation might play in deciding whether a personnel, something that does qualify as a personnel action on its own, is actionable?
I think it is a significant task to attempt to discern from the legislative history what Congress believed Russell meant. One of the difficulties of this court attempting to discern on its own what Russell meant is we would have to try to determine what Congress felt Russell meant. And that isn't really clear from either the legislative history or the text of the statute, other than it would seem that the definition of retaliatory investigation, at least as it relates to damages, was incorporated, and that from looking over the legislative history, there was a concern about, you know, the chilling of actual investigations by the threat of litigation. But, I mean, attempting to discern, I think it's a difficult, if not impossible, task to attempt to discern what Congress believed Russell stated, given the ambiguity in Russell.
I was just going to ask you two questions. One was, in the significant change argument being made by Mr. Sestak with respect to the investigation being a significant change and falling within that definition of a personnel action, do you see where the board actually ruled on that in its opinion?
I see that they didn't accept it as a personnel action, but I mean, the entirety of their ruling would be found on appendix pages 8 and 9. And no, I think they focus primarily on the question of whether or not it was included as a personnel action. They don't expressly address the significance.
Okay. And then similarly, in your brief, you seem to concede that the board could consider the investigation as part of the reprimand letter analysis. And the board cites to Russell, but I don't see them anywhere really grappling with how that investigation and the reprimand letter, they don't actually apply Russell. In other words, they give homage to it and cite Russell and say that the investigation could be considered as part of, you know, looking at the reprimand letter, but they don't really do an application of that. Do you think I'm missing anything?
No, I mean, I don't know of any actual fact findings related to the investigation other than those few pages that exist and the pages where it's talking about in terms of whether or not it's a personnel action.
Well, why, under your view of Russell, then, wouldn't we have the remand?
Because, Your Honor, the issue raised on appeal is whether or not it was a personnel action in the first instance. And secondly, you know, I believe even if the board did err, neither Ms. Kindred or Ms. Amos had knowledge of the protected disclosures. So I don't think you can get to...
Well, but is that for us to determine, or...
That's actually a finding of the board.
Where's that a finding of the board?
Page 10 and 11 of the appendix, Your Honor. Specifically, second paragraph down on page 10, and the... next to last paragraph on appendix 11.
So this goes to, even if the investigation could be considered as part of Russell, it wouldn't change the outcome here?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm out of time unless the court has further questions.
I'm, I'm not sure that I see where this finding about the individuals responsible for the investigation is made. I see a finding about Amos, but where's the other finding?
The other finding would be on Appendix 11, Your Honor.
Which sentence?
That would be, and I will, I'm sorry, you're finding Amos on Appendix 10 is Kindred. Kindred was the management official who raised. Kindred had neither actual nor constructive knowledge of the August 2012, October 2013 OIG closures by appellee. Accordingly, I find
Kindred
the appellee failed to meet his burden.
Who initiated the investigation?
Kindred initiated the investigation, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, you've got 2 minutes.
I would just like to address three very brief points. First, with respect to the analysis as to whether or not this investigation was in reprisal, that would have to be determined ultimately by the board back on remand. The issue here, I believe, is whether or not Russell should be looked at again, and I believe it has to be. Looking at the Russell decision here right now, one of the conclusions is that an agency's selective use of investigations, i.e. its choice to investigate a whistleblower because of his or her status as a whistleblower, would contravene the goal of there being no harm to the whistleblower. And in Russell, they consider the appellant's claim of, quote, retaliation by investigation. So again, it goes back to this, to the distinction of why did Congress not want to include as an investigation as a named personnel action? It's because we don't want to prevent, as Your Honor, as you mentioned, you mentioned investigations by management-directed investigations. I'm looking to see what the genesis of the investigation is once there is a personal action and you go through the whistleblower reprisal analysis, right? You can determine whether or not that investigation was initiated for purposes of trying to figure out what was going on in an office, perhaps mismanagement or just an office that's sick, versus specifically going after an individual for a retaliatory purpose. Again, is it a retaliatory investigation or is it a management-directed investigation?
What about the express finding that was just pointed out to us about Kindred, who is the person who started the investigation? It says she credibly testified that she had no knowledge of the appellant's OIG contacts, and specifically that she had no knowledge of the August 2012 and October 2013 OIG disclosures by the appellant.
And that's why I would go back to the board to determine whether or not, one, had any of the board members who were appointed had any impact in the investigation to diversely target Mr. Sistek. And two, we also, and it's not really, it's an issue in the briefs, but not something I wanted to focus on, was having the administrative judge also go back and determine whether or not she followed the guidelines in making witness credibility assessments.
One of the questions I had asked you before you sat down was, where is that in your brief about the board members?
Yeah.
Did you find it?
I was listening to, I'm sorry. I don't believe that I made that argument necessarily about the board members. I saved that for
Okay. Thank you. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.